He does it. You do the triple gavel, don't you?
Yeah,
I call to order the House Committee on Energy, Environment, and Water. It's Thursday, May 19th. We'll have committee members in other places for other bills, and it's just that time of the year. But we do have, I think, quite a bit of interest in the informational topic of today over generation. So don't take the committee's attendance or lack thereof as an expression of interest or lack thereof. We just have a lot of things going on in the building this afternoon. We're going to hold over the possible work session on Senate Bill 626 until Tuesday. So please note that on the agenda, that that's being carried over until our next meeting on Tuesday. And I think that's all of the work business for today. I'm going to open an informational meeting, and we have a panel of three. Steve Oliver, Rachel Shimshack, Scott Corwin. I don't know if you've talked amongst yourselves. I propose to have all three of you up in a single panel. We can kind of take questions as they come, but why don't we bring the three of you up, and Mr. Oliver, you could lead off. And obviously, this topic's been in the news quite a bit over the last year, and especially over the last week.
He's the tallest one anyway.
There we go. This committee operates on a height-first basis. So,
or perhaps width.
That way I always go last, but you can't answer the
question. And yes, sir.
I'm going to introduce myself, Chair Cannon.
Can you point the microphone his direction? We do want to make sure this is all on the record and official.
Okay. Chair Cannon, Chair Gilliam, and other members of the committee, Co-Chair Boone, I'm here today to introduce Steve Oliver, who's our Generation Asset Manager, our Vice President for Generation Asset Management. I'm John Taves, BPA's Constituent Account Executive for the State of Oregon. And with that, I'll let Mr. Oliver get going here, and I'm going to put the clicker here for him.
John, just given the setup, it might be easier. Yeah, probably just to go ahead and do it because it'd be hard to reach out. Thank you, though. Co-Chair Gilliam, Co-Chair Cannon, and members of the committee, thank you for the opportunity to speak with you today on this matter. I'm going to go ahead and jump right into the presentation. I brought a PowerPoint presentation here because there's a lot of information and some of it works out best visually. I want to start off before maybe hitting this first slide by saying I know there's a lot of dissatisfaction in the wind community and some of the environmental community with this policy, and Bonneville Power Administration is extremely supportive of wind development in the region. We'll be talking about that maybe a bit later, and we felt like this was a very difficult decision to arrive at in terms of implementing this policy, and we hope to continue working with the region, wind community, and other interests in the region to solve this problem over the long run. At this point in time, it's an interim policy, and we felt it was basically our best choice at this point in time. So that being said, what were we thinking when we developed this environmental redispatch policy? And I wanted to share with you that our system priorities when we were looking at this, number one is always to preserve the system reliability. And that was true in this case as well. Secondly, in this situation, there was, and I'll go into this in more detail, it was important to basically protect a threatened endangered species consistent with directions we've been given at this point in time. And third, we're always interested in paying attention to appropriate cost allocation and cost causation, and we felt it was very important at this point also to avoid cost shift to BPA customers. And finally, we were trying not to lose sight of a long-term purpose of supporting renewable integration.
And Mr. Oliver, I hope you will take a step back and maybe coming to explain exactly what the policy was, and,
yes,
and maybe not even for members of the committee, but for anybody who's paying attention to this and might be tuning in. We have a vast listening and watching audience.
Okay. My plan was sort of to walk through and build up to that point.
Oh, okay. Very good.
I was going to talk about the conditions, but because it's a fairly complicated mechanical mechanism in terms of environmental redispatch, but let me walk through the Well, just to address the question, I think maybe it would be best up front. Environmental redispatch is a situation where when there is essentially more generation supply in our control area, and the control area there's has a responsibility to balance load instantaneously, loads and resources. When there's an oversupply of generation, and in this case, we're arriving at a situation where only wind and hydro generation exist at the margin. Everything else is shut down, and all of the interties are essentially full exporting energy. At that point, physically, you must turn something off in order to maintain reliability in the system, or you will cause an over-frequency condition and a instability in the electrical grid. So you have to constantly, electrical systems have to constantly match generation with load. And we're actually in a situation when there's so much hydro generation occurring at this point in time that combined with the wind that has been developed in the region, it is more many hours than can be consumed in this region. And so a choice has to be made on turning something off. So that's the fundamental issue in this. And this condition is occurring this year, and so I'll explain that in more detail as we progress.
Great. Thank you.
Mm-hmm. So a little bit more background. This is not a surprise. I guess we identified and have been discussing this issue with regional wind interests and other parties since 2008. So it's something that we've been aware of as a potential problem. And we've had several dry years. Obviously, this year is a much wetter year, and we'll talk about that. And it's sort of led along with the very rapid development of wind in this region that's led to sort of this issue arising at this point in time. And then I already talked about just a moment ago the reliability requirements about balancing loads and resources. That's necessary constantly. I don't think anybody envisioned when we were looking at this the likelihood of wind and hydro competing with one another at the margin after everything else had been shut off, but that's the condition that we're hitting, sort of a too much of a good thing situation in some ways. And then third, I want to make the point that people understood that the Pacific Northwest, with the amount of hydro resources that it has, ran into this problem even before wind existed. So the development of adding 6,000 more megawatts of wind to the greater region and 3,500 of that to the Bonneville control area really was something that, you know, I think was understood and expected that we were going to have problems during springtime, and we've magnified the problem. And lastly, a point I want to make is that a lot of people are saying, well, why can't you just spill more water on the hydro system and just solve the problem that way by turning off essentially hydro generation? And what we run into is sort of a conflict between, legislative, environmental, court direction, and we basically are required to manage the system consistent with, at this point in time, court orders coming from Judge Redden's court in the BIOP litigation process, and an April 21 court order regarding this spring's operation attached the 2010 what's called the Fish Operations Plan, and that plan states in part, and this is a portion of that, that the Army Corps of Engineers will manage spill for fish passage to avoid exceeding the 120% total dissolved gas in project tail races and 115 total dissolved gas in the forebay of the next project downstream, consistent with Washington TDG supersaturation limits. And they're referred to as gas caps and spill caps. And so basically we're operating in a situation where we have a court order saying that we need to manage the system to manage dissolved gas. So that's a bit of background. So let's talk a little bit about what's happening now in terms of the supply that, you know, is producing so much carbon-free electricity here in the Pacific Northwest that we really cannot consume all of it. What you see is a graphic of the runoff, which is in millions of acre feet, which is a square acre, 1 foot deep of water. So, and this is the volume that is run off from the January-July period on the Columbia River as measured at the Dalles. And the reason we measure at the Dalles, by the way, it's the lowest point on the system besides Bonneville that's not affected by the tides. So it's the place that you can measure most consistently. And so what you see here in this red bar is that it's we're closing on, and this is just a preliminary number, we're closing about 125% of average normal annual runoff here on the Columbia Basin system. And what you've seen is that we've been really dealing with a dry period for 8, 9, 10 years with little exceptions. And so over the same time period, we've had new resources introduced to the region, and I'll talk about that, but suffice it to say we have a very wet situation this year. Combined with that, over the last 4 or 5 years, we've seen essentially exponential growth in the amount of wind being added and interconnected to. This is just to the Bonneville balancing area. And once again, a balancing area has the reliability responsibility to make sure all loads and resources are balanced and all NERC reliability and other required standards are met. And this is the amount of wind that's being added to the system. To give you a perspective, the Columbia Generation Station nuclear project is 1,200 megawatts. So it's essentially we're looking at about the three Columbia Generation Stations worth of wind power being added from a just an installed capacity sense. So there's a lot of wind coming into this region as well. Only 300 megawatts of this wind is being used to serve load in the Bonneville load area. So out of the 3,500 megawatts that are here, all of it's going to other utilities, some in the Pacific Northwest and many in California, to serve their needs and to meet the renewable portfolio standards. So as the operator, we're dealing with massive operational issues, interconnecting the wind and dealing with it, and I think we've been working very constructively with the wind community to encourage and develop solutions to that. But at the same time, now that we're in the spring condition with a lot of water coming off, when wind fronts move through and this wind generates, basically puts 3.5 nuclear plants worth of energy on an hour that wind's blowing into the system, and then if that wind disappears, it moves that off the system. So we're dealing with that additional injection of energy into this control area. So let's put this picture together a little bit. What does that mean exactly, going back to what we were just talking about? What you can see is that the red wavy line in the middle of the screen, that's the load in our control area. So, and what it shows is on in the morning, there's a, you start off on the far left, and that's at nighttime when the loads are low, and then it rises into a morning peak, eases off a little bit, and then comes into an evening peak, and then it goes off again at night, and it keeps doing that throughout the period. And you can see that it basically vacillates around 5,000 to 7,000 megawatts between night and day. That's how much load we have. That's how much power is being demanded, energy on any hour. The blue line is the hydro generation in this control area, largely federal hydro generation in the Bonneville control area. So what you can see is it's producing about 14,000 megawatts on its own, and we shape that. You can see the shape of it tries to turn off at night, turn on during the day. And so you can see that we're trying to manage these massive flows of water coming down the system. Now, our hydro system is not a storage system. It can only hold about 40% of the annual runoff. It's what's called a run-of-the-river system still largely. So you can't just decide to stick it in some reservoir and wait, you know, several months before you release it. When it comes down, you manage it for flood control purposes, and you vacate reservoirs in advance of it coming down, and you try to slow it down and manage that flow. So what you see is the blue by itself more than meets the load in this region at this point in time. And these loads that are happening in the red lines, because it's springtime, are a lot lower than what you see in the summer or the winter time, because it's just milder temperature and you don't see a lot of either air conditioning or heating loads occurring. And then on top of that, what you've added to this picture is you had two other sources of supply in this region. The green line is the wind that's been added, and you can see that during this period of time that it's come up and it was blowing, this is just recently May 12th through May 19th, so it's just in the period we're in, you can see that in this period the winds come up to about 3,000 megawatts in some hours, and wind, unlike the hydro, cannot be turned on or off or shaped to meet the load, so you see that it basically blows when the wind comes through, and like if you look at Sunday afternoon, for example, even though the loads were down and the hydro dropped down, the wind was blowing at one of its highest periods at that point in time. And then the last line on here is thermal, and you can't see it very well, but it's the brown line at the bottom. And in this region, there's around 6,000 megawatts of thermal interconnected. And you can see that this time of year, when there's so much hydro and the wind's blowing, it's extremely, there's a lot of cheap surplus, and so these thermal plants essentially turn off, and there's not very much running in the region at this point in time. But basically, the combination of that blue line added with the green line so much overwhelms that red line that even when you're loading all the energized leaving the region, you don't have enough places to put it, and you have to turn something off. If you turn the hydro system off, it causes spill into the river, which causes dissolved gas. And once you reach the limits on dissolved gas, as I pointed to the Judge Redden order, then you have a problem in terms of what do you do. Our only solution really was to turn to the wind fleet if it were operating, and to ask the wind fleet to turn off and replace that wind fleet's planned generation with hydro generation so it would not be spilled. I'm going to talk about that a little bit more. So let's go. So some of the limitations we had were people say, well, why don't you just send more outside the region?
Can I interrupt just for,
absolutely,
just for a second? It appears to me from this chart that you, even setting the wind aside, you would have an overgeneration issue during a period like we've been in for the last week. Am I correct in understanding that you're already, wind aside, you're already producing much more power than you have load.
Right. And what this doesn't show is it doesn't show how much can be exported on the intertie. So the intertie can carry, I think, something in, I don't have the exact numbers at this point because they are rated and derated at different levels, but the southern intertie, for example, can carry, the AC, I think, carries 4,000 megawatts. And so there's quite a bit of this power that can be exported over interties to other parts in California and other parts of the country and Canada as well. So this picture doesn't show the fact that some of this can be reduced. And yes, but in many cases, you're right, though, just with the amount of hydro on the system at this point in time, many of our projects cannot actually put all the water they have through. It exceeds the turbine capacity in those projects. But some of the projects actually are not at that point, and if there is a chance to move water through a turbine and not spill it and cause more dissolved gas, that's the opportunities we're looking for, which are selective, to displace the wind when those conditions are occurring.
Thanks.
Sure. So people say, why don't you export more? Frankly, there's just physical limitations in the amount that you can transfer over interties. And right now, during the daytime, when there's loads up in California and other parts of the West, the interties are essentially fully loaded. At night, they're not fully loaded. And what's happening is we're seeing negative prices at those intertie points. And the negative prices basically are an indication that you'd have to pay somebody to take your energy, which is an indication that they don't have load. Basically, they're oversupplied as well in California during the nighttime periods. They have 160% water year, they have wind themselves, and they have generation that basically is meeting their load on light load hours. So there's not, although we're moving some on light load hours, there's not a lot of additional market in light load hours, and so the interties aren't loaded on light load hours always. And then we've already talked about the fact there's insufficient market in our control area to absorb all this wind and hydro, even though prices on it are coming down to zero, which would indicate that parties that could take it would likely be willing to take it if we're economic to do so. We're not finding enough load at this point in time. So what happens when, what about thermal resources, people have said, and I already showed you on the graphic, there's hardly any thermal resources running. And what's happened historically, even before the development of a lot of wind in the control area, when there was a lot of water, there's an economic rationale for thermal plants that when prices get below their operating costs, their fuel costs and operating costs, it's, more economic for them to turn their plants off, buy lower cost surplus, and meet their commercial obligations by just using lower cost surplus than generating using their high cost fuel and operating costs. So what happens is typically when you start seeing prices on natural gas plants get below, you know, the $20 kind of range, a lot of the natural gas plants turn off depending on what gas prices are going at. And then when you see prices get down into single digits, a lot of the coal plants will turn off. A lot of the thermal plants also plan their scheduled their outages for maintenance this time of year because they know there's a lot of surplus low-cost energy that they can go ahead and meet their commercial obligations with during this time period. So in essence, thermal plants will turn off and respond very well to this time of a period with just low price surplus power. So The only reasons that we see that they will not turn off is if they need to run for reliability reasons. And there are some plants throughout the region in the western United States that have to operate to supply reserves and also to follow load and that type of thing. So there are some reasons why thermal plants will not turn off. And there's also, if we're asking them to turn on and off rapidly, at times just the startup and stop cost could exceed the fuel savings type of a cost. And then so there's some plants that at times have mandatory fuel constraints and have coal pile constraints or something of that nature. But generally what we see is a very large and clear response to low-cost power and thermal displacement. Well, what the next question is, what about wind? Why wouldn't wind turn off if there was zero cost energy available? Well, wind, just like hydro, is an excellent energy, carbon-free resource, and it has zero fuel cost once you've made the capacity investment. So there is some O&M, but relatively small O&M cost. But the reason that wind really is not incented from our perspective to not turn off when there's this surplus and essentially free energy available for replacement is that some of the wind plants, not all, but some receive protection tax credits, which are incentive to produce as much as they can in terms of when the wind is blowing. And then secondly, states under the renewable portfolio standard type of construct have designed renewable energy credits in order to basically count and meet those renewable portfolio standards. So essentially they get paid to produce anytime that they can produce, and they have the ability to do that. So that means that if you're a wind generator, in order to be incentivized to turn off, you'd have to get paid to recover those kinds of credits that you get or your customers get that you've passed through as a consequence of turning off the wind and not having it operate. So that's one more building block piece that I do want to talk about just for a minute, is what about this spill issue? Why can't hydro just spill some more? Why can't you just turn off more hydro instead of turning off the wind? And essentially, total dissolved gas, if you shove a lot of water through spillways rather than putting them through generators as it spills into the river, forces gas into the river, and it can cause gas bubble disease. And the Clean Water Act typically allows 110% of total dissolved gas supersaturation. There is a waiver process, though, because it's considered to be good for fish migration, juvenile migration, when they're moving out in spring and summer. It's good to have more spill. That there's a waiver process that the Army Corps of Engineers, which manages and operates the projects, requests from Oregon as well as Washington, which then allows greater levels of TDG in order to support the biological opinion. So in those time periods, it moves to Oregon and Washington have slightly different standards, but it moves, instead of 110%, it moves to 120% in the spillways, which is in the tail races, which is after the dam, and 115% in the forebays, which is before the dam as the water is moving down.
Representative Gilliam.
I can just interrupt for a second.
Yes.
Just to understand the gas a little better, mm-hmm. is the faster we spill, or the bigger volume we spill, the gas, is it nitrogen that it's going into the water and killing fish?
It's all the gases that are in the air, so it would be oxygen, nitrogen.
It's forcing all the gases.
But nitrogen tends to be the one that people point to, and it creates something similar to the bends type of a situation in humans in terms of just putting a lot of dissolved gas in the river, which is brought in to the biotic systems that are in that. And so And the situation is that when you move water through turbines rather than spilling it, plunging it as long into the water, it produces significantly less dissolved gas. So by generating, after you've met all the spill requirements under the BIOP and you've come up to the spill caps, if you have too much dissolved gas for too long of a period, it's been found that that can cause a problem. And, you know, there's debate around that. A lot of people say that you could go higher, but these are the standards that exist at this point in time. So, you know, basically our position is that the federal Columbia River Power System will be operated to meet standards set in the Clean Water Act and any related waivers. And now Oregon does basically say they have the same standard for 120% in the spillways, but Oregon says, hey, we're willing to go to higher dissolved gas in the forebay, which is before the dam. than Washington. Washington says we want 115. We want some of the gas after it passes the dam to dissipate before you get to the next dam, and we want that to be 115%. Because that's the more stringent standard, and you saw back again at the Redden order at the beginning, that is the more stringent standard. That is the one the Army Corps of Engineers operates to at this point in time. We've done studies looking at the difference between that, and right now there's some things out in the press and things being said, well, why don't you just go to the Oregon standard? Well, we don't go to it because basically we're operating the more strict standard at this point in time. But looking at the difference, especially in a high-flow year like this, it does not make a substantial difference in solving this problem. So we have that analysis, and I think we've posted it in terms of being able to look at
one
it.
One quick follow-up.
Sorry.
Sure.
I just want to get a little more information on this. Is there any way to accurately estimate if we're killing fish, or have we killed fish due to this, to the TDG?
No, I don't think we've. There's constant monitoring that goes on in terms of gas bubble trauma or disease, and what you see is on all of these projects, you see us go above these dissolved gas levels at time. But basically, the rules basically say if you have the ability to control this and manage it to these levels, you're required to do so. If you cannot control it, if there's more water than you can manage in terms of going through your turbines, and or there's inadvertent types of reasons you have to do for flood control operations or something that you can't control, then if you go above that and you can't control it, there's nothing you can do about that. And we have gone above these levels historically, and we're going above these levels right now on the Lower Columbia and Lower Snake, where there's more flow than can be put through the turbines. All the turbines are loaded. There's no way you could make less dissolved gas. And at that point, there's recognition that those waivers and those dissolved gas limits can be exceeded. Our conundrum really was, it said that if you can do something about that, if you can do something about it, you're required to do it. And we saw that putting water through the turbines and using that electricity and giving it free in replacement of the wind generation that was being scheduled to generate was the next best thing we could do. Although that's the last thing we do, and I'll be explaining that more in just a moment. So what is environmental redispatch? This gets back to Co-Chair Cannon's question. Basically, if there's an oversupply of generation and BPA has reached our limit to reduce federal hydro through additional spill, then environmental redispatch is a means to maintain load resource balance consistent with those limitations in our balancing area or control area. And so how do you get to that? You know, what is the order of events that you do to arrive at that point? And we basically do constant studies and analysis. We're given by the Corps of Engineers the amount of spill that you can arrive at to get to these dissolved gas limits, and that changes depending on ambient temperature and other things going on. But we're given that operational information. We have to make sure we're meeting power obligations, fish operations, all other needs of the system, and we do studies to balance that constantly. And what we try to do is we try to do everything we can to put water places to slow it down and not have it overwhelm the system, to spill water where we can up to caps. We try to market as much power as we can so we make sure we're putting water through the turbines. Basically, we try to defer maintenance so that we have as many turbines available and as much transmission available to move it out of the region. We move water off the system by pumping it into Banks Lake up at Grand Coulee out in the irrigation projects. We ask Canada, BC Hydro, to reduce flow coming out of Canada where possible. And we've reduced and shut down Columbia Generation Station this year. Last year, we actually asked them to reduce significantly. This year, they're out for biennial fuel replacement or fuel servicing. So they're down completely at this point. And then we spill all the way up to gas caps, which sometimes is thousands of megawatts of reduced hydro generation. And then we also reduce what's called balancing reserves, which is fairly complicated. We reduce reserves being held on the system. And we offer to do spill exchange with other hydro systems. So if hydro systems somewhere around the West, if we could give free energy to them and they could spill for us instead of us spilling, we've offered to do that. And then other steps we take after operational steps is we basically have to get down to the point of offering free energy into the market to ensure that everything is being taken, all the market is taking as much hydro as possible prior to before we move an environmental redispatch. We have to spill up to gas caps before we get there, and like I said, sometimes that's as much as the wind fleet right now, several thousand megawatts. And then the next thing we do is we reduce all thermal generation in the control area. Most of that, as I said, decides to shut down economically anyway, but if they don't, the next step we take is to call them up, offer them free energy, and if they don't accept that, then we actually direct them to shut down to their minimum generation level. So they're actually told to shut down. And then the last step, if we can't manage everything, the last step as a last resort is that we turn off wind. So a lot of people are saying we're discriminating against wind. And frankly, we do everything we can operationally to spill the hydro or turn off the hydro, and then we turn off the thermal. And the last thing we do is turn off the wind. So it really is it's at the margin is the last thing, not the first thing in terms of any kind of discriminatory action. So what happens then when we do turn off the wind? We basically provide non-carbon producing hydropower to replace the schedules. So the wind plants each hour looking at what kind of wind's coming through the area, how much power they're planning to deliver to their customer. That's called a schedule each hour. And we basically have them keep that schedule, but we tell them to turn off their plant, and we provide our energy into that schedule rather than their hydro energy, and we provide it to them free. And so they can meet their commercial obligation based on what the wind was going to do that hour, and allows us to put water through a turbine, not do dissolved gas spill, and basically keep them whole in terms of their energy transaction. And then whenever we get through a period where we don't need to do that anymore, we terminate that condition, the environmental redispatch condition. And then finally, I want to make sure it's clear that we've only adopted this as an interim policy as we continue to look at longer-term solutions. That's a segue to the next slide. What are the potential long-term solutions? Well, number one, this problem is going to keep happening. It's not going to go away. It's only probably going to get worse as more wind. We work with wind community to get more wind developed and connected here in the region, and other renewable resources might develop in the region as well. And so the things that you could look at for long-term solutions are you can do some extremely costly infrastructure like building new high-voltage interties or storage facilities. But you really need to carefully consider those solutions, because this problem is a problem that may show up in some years and it may not show up in others. And it may be 5 or 6 or 8 weeks long some years, and it might be 1 week long other years. So if you build this large infrastructure and it costs, you know, billions of dollars potentially and has its own environmental impact, the question really is, you're solving a problem which is a matter of weeks, and it's sort of intermittent depending on these conditions. You have to consider the cost benefit and the practicality of that. The next thing you could do is you could develop some seasonal intermittent loads. A lot of people have said, can you develop, if there's free energy here in this region at times, there's a big surplus, can we consume that in some constructive way? And so, are there ways to allow loads to consume that? It has somewhat of the same problem as the one I just talked about, which is if you're going to base the business economics of some sort of load on getting the surplus in the springtime, it may not be there every year. So you have to have a pretty flexible, robust kind of a business that can take in the surplus at some times and not rely on it, though, for its business survival every year if it's not there. And we used to have some large aluminum smelting kind of capability in the region, and that had the ability at times. And then lastly, we've been proposing something as a long-term solution that would allow the wind parties to take in and turn in something at the end of each month when this is occurring to California, Oregon, and Washington, Regis, renewable energy credit kinds of mechanisms, data collection kind of mechanisms that would say, hey, I got environmentally redispatched by Bonneville trying to manage this solution. Continue to give me my renewable energy credit under these conditions. And same thing with production tax credit. So we've been proposing legislative solutions that would make the wind community whole and not harmed by continue basically, if we displaced their schedules with carbon-free hydro, to continue getting the REC and PTCs. Once again, we would produce that at zero cost. We provide the energy to them, and we're asking that the payments continue to be made to them. We're not interested in the payment. We're not interested in the hydro being classified as meeting any kind of requirement other than in this environmental displacement situation. So the last thing I'd say is that we plan to continue to engage regional interests to find a longer-term solution to this issue, and we regret that we've arrived at this point, which is so contentious. And then there's some web links for a lot of people if you want to go in and get real-time data in terms of what's happening. That's my presentation.
Thank you very much. We appreciate the thoroughness and the careful presentation. Are there any questions quickly for Mr. Oliver? I hope he'll remain up here because we'll hear from our other guests. Rachel? No? Okay. We'll go to you last, Rachel, then. So, Mr. Corwin.
Here.
Boy, girl.
Not put it too close.
Okay. Get the feedback. It's not working.
We'll be fine at that.
Yeah, it's sensitive. Okay. Don't worry.
Good afternoon, co-chairs, vice co-chairs, members of the committee. My name is Scott Corwin. I'm the executive director of the Public Power Council, and I thank you for the opportunity to talk with you today on this topic. Actually worked here back in the 97 session, which dates me, but it's also the last time we had a big, real big water year than this, as Steve showed on the slide, and had to deal with associated issues. Public Power Council, or PPC, is a trade association representing consumer-owned electric utilities of the Pacific Northwest with the statutory rights or preference rights to purchase power that's generated by the Federal Columbia River Power System marketed by BPA. These preference rights were granted to publicly and cooperatively owned utilities because they have a mandate to pass the benefits through to the citizens who are their consumer owners. Our utilities have service territories in portions of seven western states. In Oregon here, there are rural electric cooperatives, people's utility districts, and municipal utilities that buy power from BPA. So they're owned and answer directly to their customers, and so they focus very carefully on the rates they pay for that power and transmission. BPA, what Steve, I don't think, mentioned, is... It's a federal agency, but it operates as a pass-through entity for costs and rates. So if they take on a cost or pay an additional cost, they need to collect it in rates. They are not subsidized by the federal government or federal taxpayers at all in that respect. So all of their costs come to our ratepayers in public and cooperatively and municipally owned utilities on the power side and transmission as well, although there's other customers there. PPC members support efforts to responsibly and add cost-effective renewable resources such as wind to the region's electric generation resource mix. In fact, we have members who are owners of wind projects and purchasers of wind resources. So we're interested in finding and furthering these long-term solutions to these issues. Effectively integrating these intermittent renewable resources poses a number of challenges, however, that need to be properly addressed to ensure effective operations, system reliability, to keep the lights on, and proper cost allocation. This hydropower system is particularly well suited to integrating these intermittent resources in general, but there's a limit to this available capacity of the system and its flexibility, especially in situations like right now where they have an upper limit on their ability to move the system around. Further complicating this dynamic is this pace of development in the Northwest. Steve touched on this, but it's really notable. We've been scrambling to kind of catch up technologically and operationally with this enormous growth of wind. In 2005, the BPA area was integrating about 250 megawatts. That amount doubled in 2006 and again in 2007. And now they've got over 3,500 megawatts of wind being integrated into the system, which is about a 1,400% increase in those 6 years. So you saw that on Steve's chart, but it really is striking. And I think BPA and the region and the developers and utilities should be acknowledged for that success, for this massive effort to vigorously pursue integrating this large volume of renewable energy so quickly, in addition to the and often using the flexibility of renewable hydropower generation. Steve covered the basis pretty well on this, the dynamic of this overgeneration that we're faced with right now with a large influx of water. I would note on this policy, this interim record of decision that Bonneville adopted, our membership is supportive of their approach on overgeneration here during the spring runoff season. We believe it's a solid approach. It meets their obligations of the federal system and reflects prudent business practice and helps meet the legal requirements certainly designed to protect fish on the system. In line with that policy, we agree they should use all other reasonable means to dispose of excess federal generation during high water events before redispatching generation, and agree with their approach on approaching wind as a last resort. We believe they should adhere to clear and transparent steps to reduce a spill during high runoff conditions with those specific triggers that they outlined for environmental redispatch. We don't think they should pay entities to take federal hydropower. They get it replaced for free, as Steve outlined. But replacing a lost federal taxpayer subsidy, such as the production tax credit or renewable energy credits, is a different matter and should not be on the Bonneville Power ratepayers. But having said that, we've committed as customers to work with BPA and the other stakeholders on some of those policy changes or long-term solutions. One of those, Steve mentioned, is a place where the state of Oregon could have a role, and that's recognizing that replacement federal hydropower as eligible for renewable energy credits. But I think we should have a larger discussion about what is possible on policy changes that can address this issue and keep folks whole and under these scenarios, and we commit to do that. The bottom line, public power understands these are extraordinary circumstances. They require extraordinary measures, and we appreciate BPA's efforts to seek the solutions that meet their statutory obligations and commit to continuing to work with them and other parties on the longer-term solutions. So, yeah, thank you.
I appreciate the testimony. Mm-hmm. Representative Boone.
Thank you. What will happen to our federal government, because I'm not going to count on the state to do it anytime soon, designates hydro as renewable?
It depends where it is certainly a renewable resource, and it's a non-emitting resource, which is nice from a climate change perspective. It depends where and how they do it. So if they recognize that, for example, when they renewed authorizations for the production tax credit in this instance, that, you know, to the extent there were new projects trying to take advantage of the production tax credit, or that could be applicable to the old projects, that would certainly help in this scenario.
Paul?
Have you heard if there's any activity in this area?
There, with respect to recognizing hydropower, there is. In fact, there's a different discussion going on the federal level now that's a little different from the renewable portfolio standards that we've seen, especially on the West Coast states, but others. But it's talking about a clean energy standard instead, and hydropower has been teed up as potentially part of that discussion. It's a different approach, but the Obama administration has mentioned that, as have others, and that's partly because of that climate change dynamic. Hydropower is a key resource nationally that without emissions. So,
Representative Pence.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm sure it was somewhere in the earlier presentation, and I didn't catch it, but the thought that wind power enjoys the same level of what? Right to produce as the pre-existing hydro systems. It seems, I'm not quite sure I understand if it does. It seems like we had the hydro systems, we could put the water through the generators because we weren't burdened with all of the massive amounts of green power. Now suddenly we have the intermittent generators, and we're going to have a lot more of it soon. The question is who has the prior right, if you will? It sounds as though this decision ultimately was that we could place the water through the generators, avoid the gas problem, but we had to for some reason reimburse the wind power that we turned off. That assumes some sort of a level playing field among all of these generators. And I'm wondering if that in fact is the case. Is it a contractual playing field that's been developed that means that those who are generating the wind power have the same right to sell the power as those that are generating it through hydro? Or what? Because it seems to me wind came along later, should have been a contractual right. I don't understand that part of what was presented up here. And did that come into play somewhere in your presentation?
It's a very good question, and it's probably a very complex answer. But it's our, position that federal hydropower has a priority access to the federal transmission system to the extent that that transmission system is not committed or has been committed contractually to other parties. So if there's something that's not committed and we have a need, we believe we have a priority access. On the other hand, over time, there's also a commitment to open access, non-discriminatory interconnection of generation to the transmission system. And so as we worked with wind parties to interconnect the wind parties can ask to connect to our balancing authority, and they're not obligated to have a path out of the region or a load necessarily to serve in the region to consume their wind, because these projects are being built in many cases to meet renewable portfolio standards. In the old days, when somebody built something, often it had to meet a certain load type of, it was built, to meet a certain type of a load. Today, with renewable portfolio standards, wind is being built, renewable energy credits are purchased, and it's being designed, to meet renewable portfolio standards. And so the care of saying, well, do you have a path to a thermal resource that you can displace outside of the region is not necessarily attached to it. And there is an open access, non-discriminatory interconnecting type of agreement. So once they connect to our area, most of the year, this works fine. Most of the time, there is enough load in our region combined with export capability that between the hydro and the wind, it's doing a good thing. It's displacing, hopefully, thermal. It's meeting load. Once you get the situation where there's so much hydro pouring out of this region combined with the ever-expanding wind, even though the wind has a transmission right to put into our grid, there's not enough paths out to all the thermal around the western United States. And so that wasn't a requirement. When you interconnect, you don't have to build path after path, of transmission to get to thermal under all sorts of circumstances. So I think what I would say is that I believe there's an equal right of generation in the region to when they've interconnected to input into the grid. I think in this particular case, what we're looking for is a solution to try to balance some very unintentionally competing environmental obligations, where we're trying to find ways to manage dissolved gas on this hydro system as well as manage the wind input. And this was our proposed solution.
Benz. Co-chairman and Representative Benz.
I'm sorry. Rachel, hang on just a moment.
I had a follow-up. Right?
Yeah, follow-up, Representative.
Thank you. this was your proposed solution, but it seemed to me, I just need to know where we're starting. Are we starting from the standpoint that everybody has equal right to this transmission and this way out for this power, or are we starting from some other foundation? Because figuring out how to solve the problem requires understanding where to start.
We believe that in the interconnection agreements that we've signed, which are called large generator connection agreements, that we've made it clear that for system operational issues, that we have the ability to request curtailment or reduction of that generation. That's true with all generators we interconnect. Absent that, I would say that there's an equal opportunity in terms of generation input.
Thank you. Go ahead.
It's all right. I'll hang. Wait for my turn.
I think you're up.
Oh, is it my turn?
It is.
How about that? We're all good. Thank you very much, co-chairs and members of the committee. I'm Rachel Shimshak. I'm the director of the Renewable Northwest Project. We're a regional advocacy organization. We support solar, wind, and geothermal in Oregon, Washington, Idaho, and Montana. And our members are both energy businesses and also consumer groups and environmental groups who are interested in transitioning our energy system away from fossil fuels and toward renewable energy. I really appreciate the opportunity to come and talk today and appreciate my colleague's background. I'm sure this is a really complicated issue for everybody, and I hope I don't make it worse. I hope I can make it better. But suffice to say, Mother Nature has been very generous to us this spring and provided a huge amount of snowpack for the mountains. And when that snow begins to melt, it fills up the river system and creates all kind of generation. And, you know, so the sun being out today is a great thing, but it's also a little bit of a challenge. Because the economy is still struggling and the amount of demand on the system isn't very high, you have a disconnect between a lot of generation and not enough demand. And that's what creates low prices in the market and the situation that we have. I know that the previous two speakers have talked a lot about the problems associated with a lot of generation on the system, but I do want to call to your attention that there are a few benefits for consumers and for the environment and for Bonneville's system. The benefits are, if you are a utility that is short on power, in other words, you don't have enough resources to serve your customers, and there's a bunch of cheap power in the system, it's good for you. You can buy cheap power and pass those reduced costs on to your customers. And so that's a good thing for those consumers. The environment, as you could see from the visual that Steve presented, there's very little fossil fuel and the nuclear plant is down, and that's also good for the environment because we have fewer emissions. The people who operate those plants don't have to deal with the emissions, and should we ever have any kind of climate regulation, you wouldn't suffer the risks associated with that. It is a good thing to have full reservoirs when it comes summertime because the power is worth a lot more in the summertime because demand is up, and it's possible that Bonneville will be able to sell some of that additional power in the summertime, create revenues, and be able to keep power rates down for its customers. So that's the good stuff. The challenging stuff, and we know that this is challenging, it presents a lot of trouble for operators when there's a lot of energy on the system and not enough load to absorb it. We also know that this particular overgeneration situation has occurred, according to Bonneville, in 30% of the years over the history of Bonneville, so well before there was ever any wind on the system. You know, nature happens, and it produces a lot of water, and we have this situation. Our view is that the current policy that Bonneville has proposed in order to deal with this situation, which has two features. One is not to pay negative prices. In other words, to stop when the power markets get to zero, not to begin to pay people to turn off generation or to take generation, and then also to unilaterally turn off the wind projects with no compensation is not a great policy. We think that there are market solutions and there are other approaches that we should be able to work together on to solve this. We think that the proposal that Bonneville has is discriminatory for the reasons that Steve mentioned before and Representative Bentz was asking about. We think there is there should not be discrimination in terms of access to transmission. The wind generators have paid for integration in Bonneville's system. They have paid for firm transmission over Bonneville's lines to the customers that have bought that generation, to the utilities that have bought that generation. So there actually is a home for that generation. The problem is really the surplus energy that's on the system and finding a home for that. Public power customers have long-term contracts. They get supply. That's good. The wind generators generate and serve customers of utilities. That's okay. And then there's a whole bunch of extra power on the system that doesn't necessarily have a home, and the question is what to do about that. A policy like the one Bonneville has advanced doesn't do anything to encourage additional renewable energy development in the region. Oregon has some very positive renewable energy policies. So does the federal government. It is our hope that there will be less fossil and more clean energy in the future. We think that's something that's good for the economy because it creates jobs, especially in rural areas, and it helps support a clean energy system. It's also true, at least according to the comments that were filed to Bonneville, that many see this as an illegal action, and they're probably prepared to sue. And that litigation will only create acrimony and really won't be a good situation for us to address an issue that I think is really a system issue. Our system is changing. We know that the Boardman coal plant will retire early, sometime before or by 2020. We know that the two coal facilities in Washington State at Centralia will retire early. There will be less coal. There will be more renewables. We got a whole bunch of certified smart people. We ought to deploy them on trying to figure out how to operate the system given those realities so that all customers are able to benefit, and that any costs associated are fairly balanced. It's not to say that there won't be costs associated with it, but we need to think together about how to distribute those equitably across the system. So, again, our short-term suggestions are Bonneville needs to put some money on the table to inspire people to bring some solutions forward. And they have taken some steps in that on that strategy, and we appreciate that, but aren't willing to put forward enough to really get people to respond. We think there's more fossil that could come off the system. We think there is transmission that could be made available if there was an incentive involved, and we think that would help relieve the situation. We also think that they could do a little bit more responsible spill, not hit their total dissolved gas limits, and it wouldn't be a total solution. It'd be one tool in the toolbox along with many others, and we're going to need a lot of tools in order to be able to deal with this. But we hope that together, all of us and many others in the region can, again, talk together about what the system's going to be like and look like in the future, what its operational characteristics are going to be, and what we need to do in order to manage that. We figured out how to work the hydro system up till now. We figured out how to integrate a nuclear plant into the system, which is a large central supply resource that can trip off in an instant, and we know how to deal with that. Bonneville's been doing a good job of integrating wind into its system. We need to figure out solutions for this issue for the future. Thank you.
Thank you, Rachel. You know, it's a fascinating problem. I mean, obviously, it's sort of your livelihoods, and I'm practically brand new to it. But it is really interesting. I mean, we have this terrific resource, which is power, and it's at certain times of the year in certain places a very valuable resource. And here's a point of time in the year and a sort of wrong time, wrong place, right? Because we've got too much of it. But it seems like it's a problem that should be solvable, right? If we could only get it when we wanted it or where we wanted it, then here's this resource that we ought to be able to sell and to monetize. So what are the barriers to that? I mean, you talked about some of the concern about storage. Well, we don't know. There may not be another high water year for a long time, so that's maybe not a real safe investment. But, you know, looking at the chart, it would appear, no, there are high water years. It's maybe not predictable in the sense of 4 years from now will be another high water year. But surely that all this excess power, we ought to be able to monetize that somehow. Maybe it's transmission, so we get it to the right place that needs it. I mean, why haven't we been able to figure this out?
Mr. Chairman, I was going to offer, and I forgot to say in my original comments, that transmission is an important longer-term strategy for all of this, and for a lot of different reasons. It may not take building absolutely new transmission, but upgrading the transmission that we have, so it may not take new right-of-ways, for instance, in order to do it. If we go north, we can access some of the Canadian storage. If we go east, we can get access to a diversity and more geographic diversity of resources. If we go south, we have access to more loads in California. So at different times of the year, those things are all valuable to the Northwest. It may be that in California, they're developing a terrific amount of solar resources, and the operational characteristics of those resources may be complementary with the resources we have in the Northwest, and we want to be able to have a way to get both ways on that highway so that we can maximize the amount of clean resources that we have.
First of all, I would say that I think every solution should be on the table, so we're willing to look at whether it's transmission, storage, any solution, so we're willing to work with the region to do that. One of the things I would say is just, you know, watching our experience with the I-5 corridor project that we see happening at this point out of this area and others, that, development of new high voltage transmission and interties, and just our experience, I worked a bit on the third AC intertie when it was developed years ago. Those projects, I believe, are all, you know, there's a lot of merit behind development of transmission and interties between regions and subregions. So, and looking at storage, would be good as well. I mean, when we've looked at pump storage types of facilities, greenfield, you're talking literally, $1 to $2 billion types of capital investment. Transmission lines are, depending on the type you're looking at, are massive types of investment as well. So, and you're probably looking at, when you're looking at those solutions, things that, unless you can reconduct or somehow upgrade, you're looking at things, in terms of large types of solutions that are probably 5 to 10 year type of a time frame. So what I would say is I think all those should be on the table. I think we're going to have some operational solutions in the interim, and, we can work on what the best way to develop those and allocate costs as well. But so I think, those are not bad ideas. I think, when you're specifically looking at this issue, like I said, because it may not be there every year, sometimes making no size of investments to solve this problem, just looking just one-to-one, may not be the answer. You may have to have other reasons, combined with this to develop that kind of infrastructure. But it certainly should be on the table, and we can look at it. And it's not immediate, however.
Yeah, and obviously, I mean, I'm not doing the math, but you talk about $1 to $2 billion of project. $1 to $2 billion project's a huge number, but thousands of megawatts of power, I mean, at least at the right times of year, for the right duration, that's I don't know, billions of dollars of revenue, right? I guess so. There ought to be some way. I'm inspired by this challenge and hope that you are too. Not that I have any answer.
I'm inspired by it, Mr. Co-Chair. It is complex, though, and I do think all those solutions seem to be looked at, not just because of the overgeneration piece, but this is a big issue in general facing the Northwest. In this particular instance, you don't know how much you'd be able to export. Again, you need a load to match it. And if Northern California has a heck of a lot of hydro this year as well, it's got to go somewhere where there's a load to take it on. But having said that, it should all be on the table. And I was going to mention one thing that the administrator did, along with the chairman of the Northwest Power and Conservation Council, was try to get a lot of regional folks together again, including Rachel and myself, and we're going to be meeting on June 6th to kind of take another look at those longer-term solutions and some of the other associated issues.
But, Mr. Chairman, I would argue that there are economic issues and solutions that could be pursued in the shorter term that would be a lot less expensive than, there's a cost curve for solutions. And building storage as opposed to using storage that's in the system already is probably at one end of the spectrum. And then there are middle and shorter term things. Because Bonneville has made a decision that it's not going to pay negative prices and that it's going to take this action with respect to the contracts it has for transmission for wind generators, it limits things a little bit, and that's where we think the unfairness comes in.
Great. Any other representatives?
Right. Follow up on that. It limits things and creates unfairness. Maybe you could elaborate.
It's possible that if Bonneville was not limiting itself to to paying just zero but not below zero, it would be able to inspire other solutions from the market to help address this issue. Who knows whether it would be enough to solve it for the short term, but, you know, in any economic situation, you have too much of something, the price goes down. Sometimes you have to pay negative costs in order to inspire an action, and an action might be to finally get the last couple hundred megawatts of coal off the system that could come off without chancing any reliability issue. Perhaps it would be accessing additional transmission that somebody else owns but would make available for a price and would allow Bonneville to get power out of the system to other loads, other places. So the other areas of the country are experiencing the same thing. The economy's poor all over the place. There's more generation than there is load, and it's not a totally unique situation for the Northwest. Those areas of the country pay negative prices. They get people to come forward with solutions, and that's a cheaper response than some of the other things we're thinking about. So I just wanted to put that on the spectrum of things.
You want to jump in,
Scott? Yeah, thanks. I mean, on that, we see the fairness issue, I guess, from a different perspective, which is if Bonneville's going to pay those prices, it's going to be, it has to be absorbed by some ratepayer. And if it's ours and they're not seeing the value of the wind resources, that doesn't seem equitable. More to the point, though, for the thermal generation coming off right now, they're not requesting that. It seems to work pretty well to give them free federal hydropower to replace. If you were going to start down that road, though, where do you draw the line? So should the thermal generators get negative prices too? Do they all hold out and not go off the system until they can get down into the far into the negative? And if in several years we've got three times the renewable resources on the system, what is the scope of that problem? So it's we appreciate where they've drawn the line here. It's not to say that we shouldn't keep looking for solutions, and I think Bonneville has laid out a dozen that they've pursued already this year, but it's a bigger issue once you start down that road, and I'm not sure where it stops.
Just on this negative, on the negative pricing issue, one of the dilemmas we have is this is just not a standard market, you know, where you'd say, you know, you have willing buyers and sellers and you decide to operate and manage your system against, you know, decisions in and out of that market. We're in a situation where the fuel that runs our system runs on the surface of the earth, and there's internet sites where people can see when that's coming down very rapidly and what the flows are in the Columbia system. You can also see what the dissolved gas is in the system that we're up against, so they know when we have no choice but to be forced into a situation of going to the market. So this is not where there's a lot of marketers out there and we're deciding to move in and out of the market and operate in some business sense. We're trying to comply with external mandates, meet those in terms of court order and other directions, and at the same time everybody can see when and if we have to do so. So on the other side, there's parties that are being paid to produce while they're interconnected to this limited hydro system. So they're being paid production tax credits to run no matter what the conditions are to the system they're attached to. And I don't think that was probably intended when people years ago looked at, hey, let's get the renewable projects going. It was a good idea to have some incentive for production. I don't think they saw the sort of the confluence of these sort of issues sort of running into each other. So, you know, if this were just a normal market, there weren't parties being subsidized, others not being subsidized, and we were in a situation where it wasn't obvious what one party had to do in the situation that everybody could see transparently, then, you know, having a discussion about, you know, negative prices and the rationality of being able to choose to move in and out of those might make sense. The other thing that I wanted to mention that Scott brought up was up till now, we've basically been able to dispose of water as spill, which is a zero cost, and or we've been able to offer low cost to turn off thermal. So we're sort of in this situation where The reason that we would have to pay, I think, to incentivize wind, as I mentioned in my presentation, was to compensate them for lost renewable energy credit or production tax credit. So that transfer, really, which should be borne by the parties that were buying the wind and wanted to make that investment, from our point of view, is inappropriate to move from national taxpayers or state taxpayers to Northwest federal power consumers at this point. And finally, the point that Scott made is once we start paying negative prices, all of the parties that right now are willing to take our energy as the surplus starts to occur at $10, $8, $5, and zero, why would you at that point, if Bonneville's going to move to that point, why wouldn't all the thermal and other marketers out there say, we know you're in the situation, we know you have to pay negative and you're willing to do so, hold out for that type of price? So we basically don't see it as sort of an even playing field type of a market to participate in.
So I know you're just itching to respond, and I have a feeling we could go back and forth for quite a while. I have a feeling that probably happens in other venues. Is it? Am I wrong about that? Is it at all helpful for you all to be talking this out here? Because I think if not, then maybe we'll just go with additional committee questions.
Yeah, we actually there's a pretty good. If you Bonneville's got a whole website on this, you can see our debate in live color. And actually, to Bonneville's credit, in their record of decision, they actually put in the comments and their responses to it, so you can actually see the back and forth.
Okay, so quick word, Rachel. Then see if there are any final committee questions.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And back to Representative Bence's question there about thermal generation. Steve is correct. The market will probably make sure that gas projects are shut down because they can come and go pretty quickly. When you're talking about a coal plant, it's a lot harder to start and stop them. And Bonneville did go out into the market earlier on and try to get agreements with some coal plants to ask for several weeks of shutdown during the spring period. And that's exactly what you want to try to get. There weren't very many takers. I don't know whether they didn't put enough money on the table or didn't smell nicely enough, or I don't know what the problem was. But that's the kind of thing you want to do. You want to have a capacity market. You want to create a value. You're trying to buy insurance. Maybe you'll need it and maybe you won't. If you wait until right now when you're in the situation, I totally agree with Steve. Everybody knows what the system looks like and they know how much extra generation there is. You're already in a difficult situation. I get that. But advance agreements are a really good idea. I think they're a good insurance policy. I would highly recommend them. There is a cost to them. Scott's members are public power utilities, and they're sheltered in Bonneville's policy from having to pay any of this. I don't think zero is the right number for them. I don't know what the right number is, but these are costs to the system. It's not just a cost of wind. It's a cost that is being generated by all the generation that's on the system, and we need to figure out a cost allocation system that's fair and doesn't prioritize one set of customers over another.
Co-Chair Gilliam, any final questions or comments?
Thank you, Mr. Co-Chair. It is an incredible problem. Energy problem when you think about the rest of the world that we have. I have a hard time understanding why we didn't know that the winds blow when the river is high in the spring and why we allowed so many breaks for a really incredible renewable source, but we did, and here we are. I guess my question is to you, Mr. Chair. Wouldn't it be great? What if there was a way to use Bonneville power when it's cheap and store that energy and then at a center of load, any size you might want, and then later burn that same power cleanly so there was absolutely nothing in the air, nothing left but water vapor, and then that line, what if that line that we saw in the PowerPoint, instead of having peaks and valleys, just evened out and we could strengthen our Northwest region's most powerful resource, which is cheap power. What if?
How did you say all that without using the word hydrogen?
Nice work.
I'm trying to
slipped that past me. No, I think it's terrific. I think that's exactly the type of creative thinking that we need. So
that's, I appreciate that. Right, and just one last follow-up. I would say, looking at Renewable Northwest Project's board or members, I would hate to be at one of your board meetings. But
why is that?
Well, it's kind of like trying to see. We can't even keep our members in the room, apparently. But I would recommend you, and I bet you already know, and have talked to some of the folks at the Hydrogen Alliance, the Northwest Hydrogen Alliance. And if you go to hydrogenhub.org and see at least the testing phase, the study phase, and see what incredible possibility there is. I don't think it's premature for them to be involved in your group, but stay tuned.
Very good. Representative Boone.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and that's a great segue into what I was going to mention. I've been sitting here reading Recharge News and your articles on EPA and what's happened this week, and Rachel, your comments in there too. And I've been reading this for quite a few years now, and watching what's happening around the world with other forms of incentives and what happens, and you know, just like Representative Gilliam's hydrogen, why isn't anybody doing anything about tidal? Why river tidal current? And it's happening all over the world. It's never going to stop until the water stops running, and then we're all cooked. But it's kind of like wave and all the stuff that's happening out in the ocean, under the ocean, and the wind offshore, et cetera. And it seems like there could be a way to help out EPA, you know, when they have their issues happening in a positive way, rather than just saying it's all your fault, you know, and you got to go figure it out. But everybody should be working together on this so that we can get to the point where we're all renewable. And, oh, by the way, I do support the making hydro renewable like they're doing in BC, and they're at 90-something percent. And that hasn't stopped them from being innovative and creating other renewable projects as they go forward all over Canada. And so I look forward to the day when we can do that and kind of join the 21st, 22nd century in our minds, where Oregon is right up there with the rest of the world as far as what we term our RPS.
And Chairman and Representative Boone, we agree with you. First of all, hydro is a renewable resource, no question about that. Always has been, always will be. We are really lucky in Oregon to have all the renewable resources that have been invented so far, and we hope that we'll be the home for whatever comes along next. We have hydro, we have wind, we have solar, we have geothermal, we have biomass, we have wave. There is some tidal stuff that is going on, although I'm not the tidal maven, so I wouldn't be able to describe those details for you. But I think we do have lots of opportunity, and I know we have people who are capable and willing to work together to figure our way through these challenges and break through to what comes next.
All of you know exactly what I'm going to say. So if we could bring our state up to speed with the rest of the world and our RPS and get rid of that arbitrary 1994 date, you know, that would really help.
Mr. Chairman.
It was somebody's idea at the start, and it maybe served its purpose to a point, but I think we're past it now.
Representative Boone, that's a different matter. That's not to say that hydro is not a renewable resource. It's to say that the renewable standards were really supporting the foundation of hydro and trying to diversify and extend the renewable energy resources. So they're meant to build on the hydro base but not recreate it. We have quite a lot of hydro in the system already. We are interested in diversifying that renewable resource, and that's what the standards are based on. They're based on new renewable resources, not existing. So that's the difference in the standard.
I understand that. It would also allow us to incorporate existing cogen and other projects that were just before their time.
So I think it's a great point, great topic. Obviously, we've had some conversation about it already in this committee, and I think we could have a lot more, and I'm would suggest that probably be a good thing during the interim. And I appreciate the testimony from all three of the good discussion of this issue. This is far more time than we give to other issues in the Oregon legislature, so you should be honored.
Thank you.
We're glad to have you here. Thanks for your good work. And with that, we'll close the informational session on overgeneration and adjourn the Energy, Environment, and Water Committee.
Thanks.